how is it that that creates a link between the two if party one should have had a flagger and didn't, and party two also should have had a flagger and didn't? They happen to be working at the same location, but if they each independently failed to take proper precautions, how does that link them together?
And the answer is because proof at trial could ultimately prove that Conrail had no obligation to have a flagman there, that Julian did have an obligation to have a flagman there, but because of their failure to have a flagman there, Conrail was on notice of a dangerous condition, ergo, Conrail is also liable. And that would be my meaningful linkage.
What is your response to the forced work argument?
All you have to do is look at what she cites. There's nothing about the flagman there. I think if you look at A83, we discuss at that appendix site the kind of work that was involved with the force account work. There's no reference to a flagman. Also, I think, interestingly, I think if you look at 219, she cited the paragraph there talking about changes in railroad facilities. She didn't then look at the very next paragraph, the very bottom, protection of railroad traffic, which talks about the contractor's responsibility relating to the protection of railroad traffic. This record certainly gives no indication whether a flagman is going to be somebody who, if put up there by Conrail, is doing it as part of force account work, that is, that we're going to be able to submit the bill to DelDOT, and DelDOT's going to say, no problem, we'll pay that bill, as opposed to, what are you talking about? That's your responsibility. That's part of your routine duties.
Can you address your opponent's argument about the exclusion, which you say is irrelevant?
Yeah.
It appears, according to her argument, to be right on point.
It's got nothing to do with this. That whole exclusion applies in the circumstance where the claim of liability against the insured is based on a liability assumed in contract. That is, somebody goes to Conrail and says, I've got a cross claim against you because you agreed to indemnify, shall we say, Julian, just abstract, all right? That their policy, their liberty policy, would typically cover that claim. It's the liability, potential liability of Conrail would be one that was assumed in contract. Then you get into the exclusions and you find out, oh, wait a minute, we don't do it if the operations are within 50 feet. But the point is, the claims we're putting to Liberty have nothing to do with the liability assumed in contract. We're saying we've been sued in tort. We're being held liable in tort. We think it arises out of the operations of Julian. You don't even get into that exclusion. It's got nothing to do with the case.
Thank you. Your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor. Appreciate it.
We'll take the matter under advisement and take a brief recess.
And the court's ready to hear argument. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Very well. Good afternoon, Ms. Stevens.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Tasha Stevens. I'm with the law firm of Fuqua and Urey, and I represent the appellant, respondent below, Maxine Lori, in this matter. A two-day trial was held in the Court of Chancery when the petitioners filed a petition for cancellation of the deed. There was a quitclaim deed that was executed by Violet Lori, the decedent, and that deed gave Maxine Lori, as well as herself, joint tenancy in her one-third of a property located on Old Meadow Road in Seaford, Delaware. Now, because of the functional similarities between a will and a deed, the trial court applied the Melson Doctrine, and the petitioner's burden was to prove by clear and convincing evidence that at the time of the signing of the deed that Violet Lori suffered from weakened intellect, that Maxine Lori was in a confidential relationship with her and was the drafter of the deed, and that Maxine Lori received a substantial benefit therefrom. The trial court found that the petitioners met that burden and shifted the burden then to Maxine Lori, who was responsible to prove by a preponderance of the evidence, or I'm sorry, to disprove any of the elements of undue influence. The trial court then found that Maxine Lori failed to meet that burden. The appellant challenges the decision of the Court of Chancery on three bases. First basis is the court's acceptance of Dr. Carol Savani's opinion on weekend.
Before you get that to that point, our standard of review, you initially say de novo. And
yes.
What is it?
It is the standard where deference is given to the trial court as long as there is sufficient evidence in the record and as long as their reasoning is the product of a logical deductive reasoning process. Initially, when I did the research, I found that there was a standard of review that was de novo, but it was later modified by the court. So I in no way intended to mislead the court. But still, the court has the responsibility to evaluate an expert's opinion to make sure it's not arbitrary and that it is sufficiently supported by the record. So if an expert makes a finding, then that finding also has to be the product of reason, of a logical deductive reasoning process. And the appellant asserts that Dr. Carol Tavani's testimony does not meet that standard for several reasons. There were she made a finding of weakened intellect based on three major premises. One, that at the time that Violet Lori was admitted to the hospital, she was admitted for numerous medical problems, and that she was delirious. The date of signing of the deed was July 30th. She was admitted on the 22nd. She had received treatment through the 30th, and when asked if Dr. Tavani believed that Violet Lori was delirious on the 30th, she responded that she did, and that was because there was nothing in the record that indicated that she wasn't delirious.
Am I correct that this procedure where there was cement injected into Violet's spine,
yes,
was the 29th of July, the day before?
Yes, the vertebroplasty. It's a pain-lessening procedure. It was on the 29th, the day before the signing of the deed. And Violet Lori signed a consent on her own, so the doctors felt comfortable with her giving a consent. And when asked about how that factored into Dr. Tavani's opinion, she answered that Maxine Lori was present, so it's okay that Violet Lori signed. But she couldn't find anywhere in the record or support that with any kind of documentary evidence. And I believe she just said, oh, I must have thought Maxine Lori was there.
So she was admitted for delirium.
On the 22nd, yeah.
And her hospitalization continued, and she had this procedure on the 29th. And when she signed the deed on the 30th, she was still hospitalized.
Yes, it was her discharge date. She was set to be discharged that day. Dr. Zimmer testified by deposition that she had seen her that morning, didn't see any evidence of any confusion or disorientation on her part, and that she felt comfortable in knowing that she had signed a document. She didn't feel uncomfortable having her sign a document on that date. May I proceed?
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you.
Just before you do, you seem to be arguing that, well, she had gotten over the delirium by the time she signed the deed, right?
Yes.
And that therefore an expert opinion that said that she was suffering from a weakened intellect should be disregarded?
No, there were three premises on which the doctor based her opinion for weakened intellect. One of them was the existence or the continuance of the delirium. And the facts in the cross-examination brought out that her basis for saying she was still delirious wasn't a stable basis, saying that she must still be delirious because it's not in the medical record that she wasn't. By the same token, it wasn't in the medical record that she was still delirious. So that premise, we're challenging that premise as not being logical or deductive reasoning process. Secondarily, the doctor said that there was Darvocet and fentanyl that created a synergistic effect and would have confused her or affected her cognition. And on cross-examination, when I asked about the Darvocet, was it even administered? The doctor couldn't find anywhere in the record where it was administered. And the fentanyl had prior been administered to Violet Lori. And I asked, well, is there any documentation that shows that the fentanyl was causing confusion in Violet Lori? and the doctor had no documentation to show that fentanyl had that effect. So the synergistic effect couldn't have existed because Darvocet was never given, and the fentanyl alone had never before caused confusion or caused a problem in Violet Lori. So that we challenged that on a second basis.
Doesn't the record reflect that after the discharge, Violet seemed to go back and forth and at least on occasion or intermittently was not lucid?
No, Your Honor. There was no record that she wasn't lucid. She was released on the 30th into rehabilitation in August. And I don't believe that she returned to the hospital until she was released, I believe, sometime in August, returned home. And then the next time she went to the hospital, it was for cancer, for hospice.
So you're saying the record reflects that after her discharge from the hospital, she continued to be lucid for the rest of her life?
I think toward the end, they said she wasn't herself toward the very end, and she died in January of the next year.
Well, the reason I ask that is because the record seems to reflect that after the discharge, she referred to the deed and seemed to be aware of what she had done.
Yes, and that's our argument that focuses, that says undue influence, you have to overcome the will of someone. So your will is overcoming their will. It was her intention throughout that time frame. She expressed it to numerous neighbors. Three of the four neighbors testified at the trial and said she always showed appreciation for Maxine and said she wanted to leave the house. And there was one neighbor, Shirley Purse, I believe, that she actually said, I gave my portion of the property to Maxine. So she was aware of what happened. It was her intention. So legally, you can't find that there was undue influence if it accomplished her intention.
Well, it seems in this record that the idea of executing the deed was really the granddaughter's idea more than Maxine's.
Yes.
And so my question is, in the opinion, does the vice chancellor distinguish between influence by Maxine on Violet versus influence by the granddaughter?
No, Your Honor. I believe that the granddaughter's zealousness is actually attributed to Maxine. There's no separation. It's simply the granddaughter sent some things in an email. She had a couple plans. Let's try this. Let's try that. And the vice chancellor doesn't independently consider Maxine's responses where she says, well, I'll see what mom says, or I'll talk to mom about it, or I'll ask mom about it. He simply seems to say this is the granddaughter has a disposition to assert undue influence for an improper purpose, and attributes that to Maxine without considering what her responses were and the interaction that all the neighbors had always observed. They always saw them together. They always saw them have a good relationship. None of them ever saw any indication that Maxine would take advantage of her mother. The CNA, Alice Fitchett, even testified that she would discuss things with her mother, and her mother would always have input. Her mother was
Remind me in the record, as I understand it, this deed was a form that you could get at a stationery store or something like that. Who obtained that form?
The granddaughter did. The granddaughter obtained it, and she either mailed it or emailed it to her mother. And I believe that she had initially said, have Mamay, that's what they called her, execute a deed now. And Maxine Lori testified at trial. She got the email, but she was more concerned about making sure her mom was all right, and that's why she requested a neurological consult to find out what was going on, because her mother was normally very lucid, very responsive, and showed good cognition. So she waited until everything was clear, until she had been examined and her mother became herself again, to ask for her to sign the deed. The appellant's assertion that she didn't have a disposition to unduly influence her mother for an improper purpose was supported by the testimony of three of the four neighbors and a CNA who came in to see the mother a few times a week to help her with personal care. Dr. Tavani relied on a note in the medical in the cheer records. I'm sorry, they're not medical records, but in cheer records, that stated that Alice Fitchett was fed up and didn't like the way Maxine Lori treated her mother. And at trial, Alice Fitchett testified she never said that, and she was surprised to see that in a record, and it just wasn't a situation that it happened. So the trial court found that that note wasn't true, and they found Alice Fitchett credible, and that's something that Dr. Tavani relied on in giving her opinion about weakened intellect. Further,
let me stop you for a second, because it sounds as if your arguments are almost entirely that the facts were misinterpreted by the trial court, and that although there were some facts that could go either way, the court made the wrong decision as to what to credit and what to not credit, and particularly with respect to Dr. Tavani. But the court was presented with evidence beyond Dr. Tavani's opinion and based its conclusions on everything that was presented in the record. How do we overturn that when, you know, there was more than one version of events here?
Well, as far as the weakened intellect finding, that is to be reviewed to see if there's a logical and reasoning deductive process. The trial court says in its opinion, we rely on the testimony of Dr. Tavani.
Well, so, but that's not all it says. It says that she was elderly, sick, in pain, medicated, recovering from surgery, and recovering from delirium. All of those things are true, right, and are in the record?
Yes.
Okay. In addition, the court goes on to refer to what Dr. Tavani determined. But the court had it additional information mm-hmm. from which to find that she was suffering from a weakened intellect at the time of the execution of the deed. So even if we discount Dr. Tavani's testimony mm-hmm. altogether, can't we uphold the court's conclusion on weakened intellect?
You can uphold the court's conclusion on weakened intellect if you look at the other aspects, I guess, besides Dr. Tavani's, but then the matter still would shift to Maxine Lori to show, to disprove an element of undue influence, and we argue that she can do so on two grounds. So even if this court were to uphold and say, we find weakened intellect, we support the trial court's decision, you still have to look at the undue influence portion that Maxine Lori had the burden to prove or disprove.
And what's your evidence on that point?
On that point, it's just the undue influence can't be found where the intentions of the testator are actually met by the document. You have to have a susceptible testator, someone with an opportunity to exert undue influence. The actual exertion of the undue influence, which produces some document that shows that effect. And in this case, because it was her intention, it was Violet Lori's intention during a time when she was witty and testy and sometimes difficult, and when her cognition was good, she always expressed, I want to give this to my daughter. I want her to have my portion. And then afterwards, she says, I've done it. This was consistent with her intentions. So Maxine Lori has disproved undue influence, and she's met her burden. So in that effect, the deed shouldn't be canceled. Further, the court's finding of her disposition to exert undue influence for an improper purpose is solely based on the court's consideration of Anne Marie's conversations and her emails, and that would be improper. If the court is going to find the disposition of Maxine Lori, it should determine it from Maxine Lori's actions. So on that basis, as far as the disproving the undue influence, the closest case law that I could find was in Melson. There was an alternative analysis done by the court, and it found that the testator, it wasn't suspicious for a testator to leave her property to one child, I believe it was Joseph and John. The testator had changed his will. So, and the court said it wasn't a suspicious circumstance that a testator would leave the property to this person who's a family member and to whom they were endeared. And this is the same case. It's not so far out that Violet Lori would leave her portion of the property to Maxine Lori, especially with the histories of the parties, wherein Violet Lori and the Tuckers, the petitioners, did not get along, and she wished she had never given them an interest in the property. And Maxine Lori came from Georgia, to come and take care of her mom for the last 4 years of her life, and she always expressed her appreciation. So there's nothing suspicious about her wanting to give her the property and expressing that, and for her telling the neighbor, hey, I did give Maxine my portion of the property. I think that proves that there was no undue influence.
But again, we're dealing with a trial court's evaluation of the facts and a determination as to what it finds credible. And although the way you describe it, it sounds, gee, you know, of course there was no undue influence here. But there's also the fact that she was in weak condition and that she hadn't taken care of it before. She had gone to see a lawyer and hadn't taken care of it, and that it also would have an impact on the people who had invested in the property, the Tuckers. So, again, aren't we, maybe this is not the right word, but aren't we left with a record that has to be interpreted, and the trial court interpreted that record, and now it's supportable? How can we reverse the trial court's findings on this? What did the trial court get wrong?
Well, especially concerning the disposition to do so for an improper purpose, that prong, where they attribute someone else's actions to the person to make a determination. That's problematic in that you have to have sufficient evidence to support whatever finding you make. And if you're going to make a finding concerning Maxine Lori, you have to make that finding based on evidence that concerns Maxine Lori. So that's problematic. And then as far as the review, the court's review, if there's something that, if justice requires that a matter be addressed by the reviewing court, the appellate, or this court, then I think this is a situation that merits such. A trial court shouldn't be able to use evidence pertaining to someone else to make a determination. It's not, I wouldn't say it was a result of a logical and reasonable deductive process. So on that element, the court can review it and can reverse it, can make a contradictory finding in that circumstance.
Do you want to save the balance of your time?
Yes, I would, please. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Perry. How are you?
Thank you. May it please the Court, Your Honors. I'm here to argue in support of the well-reasoned and well-written opinion of the Vice Chancellor, who handled this two-day trial, the pre-trial and post-trial motions and briefing and detailed argument in the Court of Chancery. I'll address in this argument, one, that the evidence and testimony showed that Violet Lori suffered from weakened intellect on the day the deed was executed, on July 30, 2004, and that Maxine Lori, the respondent, did not meet the burden of showing that the decedent was not unduly influenced.
You start with the second point, and specifically the question, you know, in response to Ms. Stevens' argument is, what evidence was there of undue influence by Maxine as opposed to her daughter?
Well, Your Honor, I think the totality of the evidence was clear that these two ladies, mother and daughter, acted in concert to do this. The emails and other evidence are sort of overwhelming evidence of their thought process as to what they were doing. The email train shows that July 11, 2004, or even before that date, they're talking about different options, different things that they're thinking of, insurance policies and other ways for Maxine to be able to keep or stay in the home. On July 11, 2004, Mrs. Lori has a bad fall, and emails reflect that it's a serious problem. She's had a bad fall. They reflect that she's gone to the hospital, that she's confused, that she's delirious, et cetera. It shows a concert, a thought process going on between these two ladies about doing something to protect not Violet Lori, but to protect Maxine and to ensure that she has some ability to live in this house after her mother passes away. By this point, Maxine has discovered that there is the deed, that it is owned as joint tenants with right of survivorship. They consulted with at least three Sussex County lawyers about it. So they're clearly acting in concert to try to come up with a way to deal with that situation.
Okay. Now, go from there and give us some specific examples of how Maxine influenced her mother.
I'll first point out that because of Nelson, I think it's the burden for Maxine to show that she didn't influence her mother. But notwithstanding that argument, I understand Your Honor's question. What evidence is there that there's undue influence? The evidence is that this is an elderly person who's suffering from a weakened intellect, who has multiple medical problems. We have some of the clearest, most contemporaneous evidence that I've seen in one of these cases. We have the discharge summary of the very day that she signed the deed. We have all these voluminous records showing her progression of treatment in the hospital, the major surgery that she had the day before she signed, the medication she's taking that day. And all this evidence shows that there's somebody who's suffering clearly from weakened intellect, who is in a very precarious position, somebody who is very dependent upon and reliant upon others to assist her. Mrs. Laurie had been in her home receiving care before Maxine came. She was receiving care from a lady named Alice Fitchett.
Remind me of the record. Who physically took the deed to the hospital? And when the deed was signed, was Maxine in the room? Who brought in the notary and the witnesses? Refresh my recollection on
yes,
those
sir.
Few facts.
I believe the record shows that the deed was prepared by the daughter in Florida and it was sent up to Maxine.
The granddaughter. That's who we're calling the granddaughter.
Correct. Ann Davenport is her name. She prepared the deed. She forwarded it to her mother, Maxine, the respondent. Maxine took it to the hospital on July 30, 2004. She used to work at this hospital. She was a nurse by training herself, but no longer was practicing as a nurse at the relevant times in this litigation. She looked for and secured two witnesses, people who did not know her mother and did not previously deal with her anything. She found a notary who I believe was employed by the hospital, brought those people into the room, didn't have her mother read the deed, didn't have any independent legal advice, didn't have somebody advising the mother whether this was in her best interest, what she wanted to do, and then simply had her sign the deed, had the witnesses sign, had the notary sign, took the deed. Without disclosing this to anyone else in the family on my client's side, the Tuckers and Patricia Coe, the other sister who was aligned with my clients, she then attempted to record that deed. It was unsuccessful because she didn't have a transfer affidavit and she had to do some more work
now,
after the fact to record it.
Part of Ms. Stevens' argument is that, for want of a better term, this is what Violet wanted to do, which would suggest that there might be evidence to the effect that Violet said, this is what I want to do, and then assigned Maxine to put the wheels in motion to make it happen. Is there anything in the record to that effect?
Certainly the presentation that was made by Maxine was on the lines of, here are neighbors, they're friends of mine and friends of my mother. They've known her for a long time. They all say that mother liked me and she wanted to do something for me, et cetera. None of those neighbors were present the deed was signed. None of them saw her on the day the deed was signed or knew her condition or saw her in the hospital. So there's evidence from prior to this that perhaps mother might have wanted to do some things for that Violet wanted to do some things for Maxine. And, of course, Maxine took her to attorneys, et cetera, to discuss this. But the focus should not be on what maybe mother wanted to do before, but whether she was competent to do something the day it was signed. And that's what the court focused on July 30, 2004, when the deed was signed. What was her condition?
All right, so that's fine with me to go back to the first point. Obviously, influence becomes irrelevant if you've got a person that had diminished mental capacity anyway. So as I understand where we're going now, you want to move away from the issue of influence and explain to us why the record supports the vice chancellor's conclusion that she shouldn't have signed the deed, even if that's what she would have otherwise wanted, because at the time she signed it, she had diminished mental capacity. Is that right?
I think that's correct, Your Honor. And I think the evidence is somewhat overwhelming in support of the Vice Chancellor's decision. We have in evidence the discharge summary on the very day the deed was signed.
And how does that show that she had weakened intellect? Does it show she was delirious? Or
It's a collection of, in answer to Your Honor's question, it doesn't specifically show she's delirious, but the discharge diagnoses that are illuminated on the exhibit show 12 different discharge diagnoses and 13 different medications. Dr. Tavani, who's an expert in evaluating competency, ability to make decisions, has done this thousands of times, testified to reviewing all these records, all the other relevant facts, all the other medical records, deposition testimony, et cetera, as to what this means. So the record that we have shows that she had urinary tract infection, fractures, COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. She had just fallen. She had osteoporosis. She had a history of problems. She also suffered from cancer. She also had limited vision. The doctor was aware of this record and all of the other medical information to arrive at her conclusions. We have in the hospital record that when she was admitted, she was delirious. We have the doctors acknowledging that she was delirious, but they were giving her medications to try to clear that up and that it would clear up at some point in time.
So was there testimony that the medications that she had taken on the day that she signed the deed would cause a weakened intellect?
In general terms, there was testimony from Dr. Tavani that the medications that she was taking or the treatment that was being rendered to try to clear up the delirium was underway, but it would not have cleared up that problem by July 30, 2004, the day the deed was signed. That plus the urinary tract infection and other multiple problems and medications, in the opinion of Dr. Tavani, made it impossible for this person to clearly understand that and to be competent to execute a deed on that date. So it's a combination of what's in the medical records on the discharge summary, July 30, 2004, what's in the medical records preceding that, and Dr. Tavani's interpretation of all that information that leads to the conclusion that Mrs. Laurie clearly was not competent on that day.
And there was no expert testimony to the contrary?
Well, there's Dr. Zimmer, who's testified, and that's mentioned in some detail in the answering brief. Dr. Zimmer is a young physician who's never testified before as an expert in any case. She saw and met Mrs. Laurie for the first time July 27, 2004. Her testimony, I think, could be summarized as she didn't see anything in the record that would say she wasn't incompetent, or she didn't see anything in the record that said she was incompetent, therefore would assume that she was. The doctor had very limited contact with her, relied in part on a neurological consult from a doctor who's unlocatable, who left the area and hasn't been found. She didn't have enough basis to come up with a good opinion, and I think that's why the court clearly discarded the opinion of Dr. Zimmer. Dr. Zimmer, among other things, didn't even know what the term undue influence meant. She wasn't familiar with the standards for evaluating competency or undue influence, and basically said, I saw her on July 27, 04. I looked at the records. There was a previous neurological consultation that said she was alert and oriented times three, so I therefore assume that she was okay when she signed the deed. The doctor didn't give that opinion contemporaneously. Maxine didn't ask somebody, she could have, she well knew that. She asked for a neurological consult when her mother came into the hospital on July 22. But on July 30, the key day, the day she's signing the deed, she doesn't ask anyone who's there for an opinion, an evaluation that day at that time if her mother is competent. We can only speculate why. My speculation is that she's concerned the doctors wouldn't give the opinion that she was competent, so she was trying to rely on an opinion that was given about her being alert and oriented before her surgery to support her ultimate claim that her mother was competent on July 30, 04. She secured the opinion of Dr. Zimmer on that issue, and Dr. Zimmer also became her personal physician. She secured that opinion from that doctor a couple of months after this lawsuit was filed.
Did Dr. Tavani assume that she was delirious, the patient was delirious on July 30th?
Dr. Tavani's opinion to a reasonable degree of medical probability that was that she was still suffering the effects of delirium on July 30, 2004.
Can we turn to something that the Melson doctrine has created, which is the requirement that a party prove a negative, which, as we all know, is a difficult thing to do.
Yes.
And having found that Violet was weakened and so on and so forth, and the burden shifted to Maxine, the court then says, okay, we need to find out whether Maxine can disprove any element of undue influence. And the court said, well, you haven't. But again, along the lines of how do you prove a negative, one of the elements of undue influence is a disposition to do so, that is to exert the influence for an improper purpose. And if I'm not getting confused here, an improper purpose is something other than what Violet or the testator or whatever actually on her own would have wanted to do, right? I mean, wouldn't that be the definition of what an improper purpose is?
Well, I guess improper purpose has a connotation that suggests somebody doing something almost criminal, but I think it's not that serious. An improper purpose would be to do something contrary to an agreement that was reached many years ago. The evidence was presented that in 1991 an agreement was struck, a deal was struck among these family members.
But wait a second. If a person owns certain property and has whatever arrangements that person has with various people as to what they intend to do or not do, and the person who owns the property says, you know, what I really want to do here, notwithstanding what I may have told other people in the past or done in the past, what I really want to do here is give this property to Maxine. Now, is it your position that if Maxine assists Violet in accomplishing that, assuming that's really what Violet wanted to do all by herself when she's totally competent, that she would be acting for an improper purpose?
I think so. I think both Violet and Maxine are acting for a purpose to defeat an agreement that was reached and relied upon. The Tuckers were added to the deed. The Tuckers secured mortgage financing. The Tuckers made all the mortgage payments, which they continue to make to this day.
But wouldn't that be a separate type of claim? Wouldn't that not be that Violet had been subjected to undue influence and done something that Violet didn't want to do, and therefore we are undoing that transaction, but rather that Violet had given some equitable rights to others, and that they could then pursue recovering what they could prove they were entitled to after Violet had made the transfer. Aren't they two different things?
I suppose they are, and I'm struggling to try to answer the ultimate question is this an improper purpose? I view the deed as being an improper purpose, I guess. There are two reasons for it. One, there was an agreement reached, and giving an interest to somebody else now is contrary to that agreement that was reached and that the court found had been reached. And two, I think Maxine is assisting, promoting. It was her idea and her daughter's idea to do this, to reverse what had been done many years ago. And by getting her mother to sign a deed, by convincing her mother to sign a deed, by acting in concert with her daughter to prepare and execute and record that deed, she's doing something for an improper purpose, not something to benefit Violet Laurie. Violet's status as a person who could return to that home and live in that home for the rest of her life wasn't being changed by this agreement. She was benefiting, Maxine was benefiting herself by having her name added to the deed via the quitclaim deed.
But arguably that's what Violet wanted, arguably, right?
Arguably, but if she wasn't competent to do so.
But if we assume that Violet actually did want to give this property to Maxine, notwithstanding the prior agreement, and if we also assume that Violet was competent to make that decision, would there still be something improper about Maxine assisting her in accomplishing that?
In general terms, no. It would be as if your mother asked you to take you to an attorney to prepare a new will or make some changes to her estate plan. Doing that certainly is not improper. But if you don't take your mother to an attorney, you prepare the document for her yourself with the assistance of your daughter and do things surreptitiously to benefit yourself, I think that is an improper purpose. The Melson formula, I think, or the Melson doctrine in estate litigation is a result of seeing situations where there's no safeguards in place to make sure that elderly people are not being exploited and unduly influenced to do things. Melson says if there's no lawyer involved who's sort of a procedural safeguard to make sure that this is done right, that this is the person's wishes, that they are competent, then we're going to make you, the person who did that plan, did that scheme, pulled it all together, come in and prove to us that the person was competent and not unduly influenced. Is it hard to disprove a negative? It is a little bit, but it has been done. If you bring in overwhelming evidence that the person was competent and this is exactly what they wanted to do, then you would disprove the competency and undue influence situation under Melson. And I hope that answers the question. That's the best I can describe it. In summing up with the brief amount of time remaining, I think the evidence is somewhat overwhelming to support the Vice Chancellor's conclusions with the age, with the condition, with the surgery, with the fact that there were no procedural safeguards, there was no lawyer involved in this procedure, there was no independent legal advice given to Mrs. Violet Laurie as to the impact of executing this deed, that clearly the burden that had to be met by Maxine Laurie to prove that her mother was competent, not unduly influenced, was not met by her. The record shows a logical and deductive thought process to arrive at these conclusions. It looked at all the evidence that was presented from friends and neighbors and family members and two expert witnesses and arrived at a well-thought-out and wrote a well-reasoned decision.
So, stated it a different way, when we're talking about the difficulty in proving a negative, your argument seems to be there's a strong circumstantial case that there was this diminished mental capacity and undue influence, and that none of the facts were in this record that you would normally see if you were trying to rebut that strong circumstantial case. And the first example you gave was that there was a lawyer involved who could give her independent advice, and right, that, you know, all the people that would benefit were out of the room, and the person would have a conversation to ascertain this is really what the grantor in the deed wanted to do.
Correct. Also of significance is that the witnesses to the deed, the notary to the deed, none of them were called to testify. None of them did testify. There's nothing in the record from these independent persons to substantiate Mrs. Laurie knew what she was doing.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, just briefly to address the improper purpose question that was posed to Mr. Ferry and the pre-existing agreement. The court actually found that there wasn't enough proof for them to assert that there was any obligation beyond Violet Laurie giving the petitioners the two-thirds of the property she gave them in 1991. So the trial court found that her obligation was actually discharged in 1991. So at the time the deed was signed, there was no obligation regarding the property and the petitioners.
What happened to this property, though, in Violet's will?
In Violet's, was this her 1985
will? The one that was held to be valid, was this property affected by the will?
The 2002 will was the one that was addressed. The property was not addressed in the 2002 will at all. That was just personal belongings of
Violet
Laurie.
What's the ownership of this property right now?
Personal belongings?
No, I know the Vice Chancellor addressed the 212 argument later on. But once this deed was invalidated, what happened to Violet's one-third interest?
It was owned as joint tenants with rights of survivorship, so the entire property passed to the petitioners.
That's what I thought. That I asked the question in response to your idea that there was no agreement. But clearly, if you have a deed that provides for joint ownership with the right of survivorship, that seems to be something that's an agreement that's evidenced by the deed, isn't it?
There's case law that a joint tenancy with rights of survivorship can be terminated as long as the person wishing to terminate it makes that intention known, and that the quitclaim deed, in effect, made her intention known. And that case law isn't out of the Supreme Court. I think it's actually out of the Court of Common Pleas, and that was addressed prior by the court.
Do you have anything else?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement, and we will adjourn.